What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
I'm Rashmi Kapadia, Associate Editor at Barron's. Welcome to Managing Your Money, Emerging Opportunity in Women's Health and Other Healthcare Stocks for Investors' Radars. Today with me is Anne Gallo, Portfolio Manager of Wellington Management, where she leads the healthcare team. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
So this is going to be a great conversation. You know, I think, as you know, last week we held our latest Level Up event series, and it was focused on this burgeoning opportunity in women's health, an area that's sort of flown under the radar for a long time, despite the fact, as our guest Lux Capital's Dina Shakir noted, it's an issue that affects 51% of the population that happens to control 80% of household decisions and 70% of the money spent in healthcare. So I know you sort of focus on publicly traded companies, but I would just love to kind of get your thoughts on, you know, how what you're seeing on the opportunity in terms of women's healthcare more broadly, and whether you think that this is a burgeoning area of interest.
Yeah, I absolutely think it's a burgeoning area of interest across both the publicly traded stock sector, which is where I predominantly focus, but also across private companies as well, where we also participate. And I think there are several factors driving this surge in interest. One, I think the key point is the point you made to start. Women are thought to account for 70 to 80% of the healthcare decisions and the healthcare spend, which is critically important. But there are other areas I think that's driving, or other factors that's driving that interest as well. When you think of the fact that healthcare is a very substantial chunk of the employed population, I believe about 17%, and about two-thirds of people that work in the healthcare industry are women. That's a really important fact to consider well.
Yeah, that's a great stat.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, another driver would be just the realization that the fact that despite what I just said, women are massively underrepresented in the clinical trial population. So only about 40% of people that participate in clinical trials are actually women. And so that's an area where we're dropping the ball from a science standpoint. Another, I think, reason is just, you know, all of the new enabling technologies and all of the fabulous advancements we're seeing in digital health has really opened the doors to women from a fundraising and a capital standpoint. And I think the number was $2.5 billion were raised in the private markets by companies looking to focus on women health, be it throughout the healthcare system, like structural women health issues, private practice, and so on, or be it in medical technologies, devices, or pharmaceuticals. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's an amazing area, and it's kind of crazy that we haven't talked about it much before, because, you know, obviously women have been part of the population for a long period of time and have been underserved. And I think that really, the $2.5 billion stat was quite striking compared to what it was just a couple of years ago. So there does seem to be at least VC interest in this area. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, when we were having this conversation with the two venture capitalists, they talked a lot about sort of the early stage market, and we can talk about some of the interesting things you're seeing there. But I think that there was also talk about how some of the bigger companies are either talking about women's health, investing more in this area, or even looking for M&A from some of the earlier stage companies. I mean, what are you seeing on that front?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're seeing all of the above. And I would say that when you look at healthcare services, for the most part, it's dominated by the large publicly traded companies. And so much of the work that you're seeing as it relates to women's health may be going on kind of under the radar or behind the scenes. But if you look across the board in terms of managed care companies, as the world transitions from a fee-for-service-based healthcare system to one that's focused on value-based care and really trying to incorporate into the focus, outcomes management, improving the health of the most people at the best cost. You're seeing a lot of thought given to how more investments in women's health can facilitate that. So definitely among the managed care companies, this is a very significant part of where they're investing directly or indirectly. You also see this throughout the medical technology spaces. One of the companies that we own is a company named Hologix, and this company is a diagnostic company. Half the business is focused on traditional diagnostic testing, and the other half of the company is focused on women's health and breast health. Mm-hmm. And, this is one of the few specific areas where you're seeing a publicly traded company really invest in significantly in innovation and R&D to deal with women's health specific issues, as opposed to the kind of the indirect investment we're seeing elsewhere. But it's not exclusive to that company by far. You see a lot of the large diversified pharmaceutical companies do the same and start focusing on women's health as an increasingly important part of their product portfolio.
Yeah, obviously it's an interesting line of growth for them. I mean, I actually just had my mammogram and I noticed it was a Hologic machine. I'm sure a very pricey one because it was one of those 3D machines. Yes. I want to remind our audience to please submit questions and we'll try to get to them as we get through the chat. So you mentioned sort of the large diversified pharmaceuticals. Obviously it's a line of growth. I mean, I kind of want to pivot away and talk also about some of the just broader opportunities that you're seeing some of these companies pursue, women's health or otherwise, out there. You know, what's kind of catching your attention as we go into this year?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm going to happily characterize 2023 as maybe a year for business as usual or back to normal after, several years of turmoil throughout the globe. But very specifically throughout the healthcare system. And I say this for a couple of reasons. One, if you are a student of the healthcare industry, one of the things that everybody has been very focused on in recent years is procedure volumes and when volumes will revert back to normal levels, i.e. the levels at which they were prior to the pandemic. And we are almost there. Mm-hmm. In terms of volumes getting back to the 2019 level. We're past it. In outpatient care, volumes have already exceeded that level as procedures can continue to shift from in to outpatient. And in inpatient, we're approaching that levels. It's dependent, of course, by area, but we're probably 95 to 99% back to where we were. But what's more important when we start to look forward isn't the absolute level, but the fact that the comparisons have now all surpassed us. And going forward, the sector, I think, will respond very well to a return to the low single digit overall kind of volume growth we've seen for many, many years, driven by aging of the population and technology advancement. So that bodes well for a number of the healthcare services companies, the hospitals, for instance, and many of the medical technology companies, predominantly the medical device companies that have really been hit hard throughout the bumpiness caused by the pandemic. Something that's similar, I would say, is also what we're seeing in the challenges of labor and inflation, both of which have been big headwinds for hospitals, post-acute care companies and medical technology companies that are dependent on hospital volume. And in no way, shape, or form are these labor or inflationary issues going to go away. But in my view, in both cases, the worst is behind us. Mm-hmm. And the labor shortages have been a challenge for the sector, not only from a cost standpoint and labor inflation standpoint, but also because of the fact Part of the reason, you know, it took the system a while to get back to normal post COVID was these staffing constraints, which just caused bottlenecks in hospitals. Yeah. And the worst is behind us there. And I think the worst is also behind us from an inflationary standpoint. Again, I don't expect to see any downward shift in prices of input costs and components, but some of the shortages are now back in supply, and the rate of increase is going down. And I think that bodes well.
That's good. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the staffing challenges and sort of, you know, just how you think that, you know, hospitals and many of these healthcare companies have been transformed by the experiences of the last couple of years, because it has really been stark, right, in terms of the bottlenecks and the shortages and the strains. I mean, how have they learned to operate in a different way? Like, what are you seeing with companies in terms of how they've perhaps changed through this pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great question, because it really has been transformative for some companies, and for some companies, much less so. I think, you know, in addition to the fact that hospitals are, you know, versus the initial days of COVID, very well equipped to deal with COVID within the hospitals, to the structural issue of labor shortages, a lot of the companies, you take HCA, another name we own, has done a fabulous job leveraging technology and centralizing functions, and has really taken itself to the next level in terms of how it operates much more efficiently throughout its very, very large organization and the many, many hospitals and communities it serves. And, you know, this part of this was already begun pre-COVID. Part of it was something that was accelerated during the pandemic. But the positive news is this sets the company up for continued success in the years and decades to come. So a lot of really, really impressive and very smart work there, just leveraging IT. And I think we're still in the early stages of that. The other thing I just think, you know, of course, we've talked in the past about telehealth. Right. Yep. This is an area I suspect the usage of telehealth will begin to tweak down from the peak levels of the pandemic, but it is certainly not going away. And, you know, what people had feared in the beginning has not yet transpired. And the fear that telehealth would actually lead to an increase in unnecessary procedures. Mm-hmm. So far, there's no proof that that's happened yet. And despite the fact that the volumes of telehealth procedures are very high, they have been replacing as opposed to becoming in addition to physical visits. So that's another area I think that we've seen technology transform and address some of these labor issues. Yeah. And again, early there as well. AI, artificial intelligence. Yeah. I hesitate to say this because it's a term that's thrown around so often and possibly misused and overhyped. But the extent to which we're seeing this be incorporated into medical technologies, medical devices, the process of surgery is really fascinating as well. And in addition to streamlining operations and opening access. This certainly, over time, as we get more data and do more analytics, will lead to better patients' outcomes.
So you mentioned outcomes, and I know you kind of touched on this in the very beginning, but we've gotten several questions, one from Mahesh about value-based care and your thoughts on sort of that ecosystem and which businesses you think are going to be advantaged in that situation. And then Mark is a physician who says that healthcare value has increased, but the volume has not decreased. So I think there's a lot of talk about sort of value-based care going forward. Can you maybe just define it and then talk a little bit about sort of who benefits?
Yeah, no. And the increase / decrease I was talking about was really a relative growth in the sector, if that helps Dr. Mark in his question.
Yes.
But absolutely, I'm a huge fan of value-based care. And it's something that we've been talking about and watching progress, albeit very slowly, for decades, actually. But value-based care is really just trying to transition from a healthcare system that's based on fee-for-service, where people get paid to do more procedures, more tests, prescribe more drugs, to one that says, you know, we're going to reward you for doing what's best for the patient, for managing the patient's overall outcomes in the way that you see fit, holistically, hopefully, as opposed to the fragmented way that we see under fee-for-service healthcare. And one of the reasons we've seen the transition accelerate as we have is new payment models have come into play where physicians are taking on more of the risk of managing the patient's care. And value-based healthcare has many definitions, and you'll hear a lot of statistics about X percent of physicians are operating under value-based contracts, or there's a lot of definitions there. Some value-based programs could be as simple as saying to physicians and other caregivers, if you meet, if you there follow these best practices as deemed by clinical societies, groups of experts in your field, we will reward you for doing that, for doing so. At the other end of value-based care, you could see physician groups taking full risk for the cost of managing patient care. So the managed care companies will say to a physician group, you know, we're getting a premium of $100 a month. We spend, the payer, 85% of that premium dollar on medical care. Mm-hmm. We think you, the clinician, can do a better job managing patient care than we are. So we'll just give you that $85, you know, and have you treat the patient as best you see fit. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the value-based care at an extreme. And I think we're early on in that transition. But from what we've seen as physicians and other clinicians increasingly move down this curve, we are seeing better cost containment and better outcomes for these patients. Part of it is just paying people to, in the past, you know, people were paid to treat. A right. lot of the softer stuff that's very important for a patient's outcome and healthcare costs weren't getting done.
Yep.
There's a word for this. It's called social determinants of healthcare, which comprise a very significant portion of the drivers of an individual's healthcare costs. And social determinants of healthcare, historically, people don't get paid for them. These are practices like ensuring the patient is taking the medicine that's prescribed, right. ensuring the patient has transportation to his or her doctor's appointment, to his dialysis appointment, mm-hmm. Ensuring the patient has adequate nutrition, so on and so forth. These are things that are very important when it comes to healthcare outcomes and medical costs, but have been falling through the cracks. You know, we talked earlier, one of the private companies we've invested in is a company called CityBlock. This is a company that was co-founded, I should say, and is now run by a CEO, Toyin Ajayi, who is just a remarkable healthcare executive. What CityBlock does is it serves marginalized populations that have very unique healthcare needs, many of which, again, have fallen through the cracks in the system. And they do this by leveraging this tech-enabled platform, which is very, very high touch and has deep, deep knowledge of community-based and neighborhood organizations, integrates with them, and is able to reach out to these high-risk, often neglected patients and provide very personalized care in a manner that's much more cost-effective. So yeah. There's a lot going on in that area that's extremely exciting.
So improving access to care and also just the outcomes, which is quite interesting. So is there a publicly traded company that you think is a good way in to sort of tap into this trend of value-based care?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, all the managed care companies are you know, and you know, I'll start out by, you know, if we want to talk about women's health, Elevance, formerly called Anthem Health, is run by Gail Boudreaux. She's a fabulous CEO with many, many years of experience. And Centene also has a woman CEO, Sarah London. And these are just, we own a number of the managed care companies very broadly. But these are two companies, I highlight them because they both are run by female CEOs, and that was the topic of of our discussion today. But these are companies that are smack dab in the middle of what we're talking about. Elevance is the largest publicly traded, or the only publicly traded, Blue Cross Blue Shield company, and it has a large commercial book of business based on that incredible brand name, and it also services Medicaid and Medicare populations. Value-based care is, as mentioned, kind of part and parcel of what the managed care companies have been pushing for some time.
Right.
And the same with Centene. Centene has a slightly different focus than Elevance, in that it predominantly focuses on Medicaid, Medicare, and the exchange, the ACA exchange markets. But again, leveraging value-based care and focusing on you know, getting the best results for the patient and aligning financial incentives throughout the system and encouraging, you know, the sharing of data and the holistic treatment of patients is core to what these companies do.
Yeah, and that data and the holistic aspect of it are so important as we go forward to try to like deal with the healthcare costs in the country.
Absolutely.
So Deborah's asking, what healthcare sectors do you see doing well in 2023? So we just sort of talked about managed care with the value-based care. Are there other sectors that you think are well-positioned? You mentioned a little bit about utilization improving and helping some areas. What else should we be looking at on our radar?
Absolutely. You know, I think I started to go down this path earlier when I was talking about stabilization of volumes and some easing of labor pressure and supply inflation. Medical device companies, I think, is a very attractive area looking out this year, because, again, these are companies that are that sell medical technology and devices to hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. And when volumes dry up, so does their business. So there's a lot of companies that I think will benefit from the combination of just this back to normal environment I mentioned, but also from, you know, a ton of innovation and attractive product portfolio and product launches that we'll see coming out over the next year or so. One company that's, I think, really interesting is a company named Insulet. I mentioned this one. Until very recently, the company was run by a female CEO, Stacey, Petrovich. And recently she had a step down and she was replaced, but she has done a great job taking this company to the next level, as has her successor. And this is a company that's benefiting from a new product launch late last year of the Omnipod 5, which is kind of a next generation pump for insulin pump, that benefits from AI and you know, monitoring the patient's symbols in real time and adjusting the level of insulin that's needed by the payers, by the patient. And so that's a company that's really interesting in that regard. I think if you look across the medical technology space, companies like Boston Scientific is another one that just, you know, the benefits of just business as usual, the massive investment in innovation over the decades, and kind of what we see coming out the product pipelines are going to be very interesting and very compelling for these stocks going forward. And really, I think the vast majority, there's many, many more companies throughout the medical technology space. Stryker is another example of a company. Used to be more orthopedic oriented, but the company really has a diversified product portfolio now across a number of fast growing attractive parts of healthcare, and is really set up based on kind of this core tailwind I mentioned, but also, you know, company and product specific innovation coming forward. So a lot of companies there and a lot of excitement there. I also would throw into the mix life science tools and technology companies, which after showing very, very, you know, strong performance during the pandemic, pulled back more recently as, you know, some of the companies started to deal with the impact of the anniversarying of COVID, mm-hmm. COVID-driven tests and purchases. And, you know, again, with what people forget is, yes, the bump you know, the very sharp, strong, short-term tailwind from COVID has dissipated. Yeah. But most of these companies generated a ton of free cash flow during this period from the testing, the COVID testing procedures that, you know, yes, may be declining. And they've put those funds to good use in many cases, you know, rolling out new innovative products, but also expanding their installed bases. So, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of companies that didn't expanded meaningfully the number or the amount of equipment that they had, testing equipment. And this creates another source of very strong growth for the decades to come for these companies. So I'd put Thermo and Danaher in that category. I also like Agilent's another company, you know, exceptionally well positioned going forward by you know the benefits of COVID and also some of the structural changes that have occurred since the pandemic, benefiting their industries.
Those are great.
People looking for more value ideas. Yeah. If you look at some of the contract research organizations, CROs, these stocks did very well during COVID and leading up to COVID, even more importantly, due to the biotech funding environment being as strong as it's been. And the multiples have taken a pretty significant hit in recent quarters. As the biotech funding environment has cooled down, thought being that growth in these companies will suffer. The reality is, however, absolutely without doubt, funding will be increasingly difficult for biotech companies for some time. But the vast majority are so well funded, there hasn't been a tick down in growth in the performance of existing trials. And yes, maybe the RFPs have begun to slow slightly, but the reality is there's enough cash and enough demand and enough innovation that these companies will be able to continue to grow through any, you know, continued turn down in the biotech funding environment.
That's so interesting. I was going to ask you about the backdrop.
Icon is one, ICLR, another one. We look at, if you are deep value, this is a company that's going through a major hiccup. So I'd only tread here if you have very, very thick skin, but a company named Syneos. LabCorp is actually one I'd put very high on the list. This is a company that is, half of its business is from a diagnostic lab, a central lab business. The other half is a contract research organization called COVID. And again, I think that company's multiple has been hit by the phenomenon I just mentioned. And I think there's upside to both businesses going forward. So that's a name I'd put highly on the list. And interesting, a couple of Chinese companies, Wuxi AppTec, for instance, is a name that has sold off late last year pretty hard, with many of the healthcare, Chinese healthcare companies, has benefited from a bounce early this year. But nonetheless, I think has a very attractive growth outlook going forward.
That's so interesting. I do a lot. Most of my time is actually spent on China, and obviously they're having a reopening as they kind of pivot on their COVID policy. So that's actually interesting, because obviously the government there is very intent on creating safety nets and providing care for especially the middle class. So that's a great one to get in there. So I guess, you know, maybe we'll close with sort of just your thoughts on sort of this, you know, sort of the longer term ramifications of what we've seen over the last 2 years in terms of COVID and concerns about it causing and what it's going to do to chronic conditions. Are you seeing more and more companies talking and thinking about that? And is that sort of one of the themes you think will play out through the sector going forward?
That's a really great question. I absolutely see more and more talk and focus among this. I would say, though, it's very early stage. The amount of data we have is very, very low. If you're talking really about long COVID and the implications there, I think it's going to be a fascinating area of research over time. But I do think, just based on how the pharmaceutical development process worked and so on and so forth. I think it's going to be a long time before we see specific treatments. Mm-hmm. But I do think over the next couple of years, we'll see more and more data that will be really very interesting. Maybe a more short-term or intermediate-term impact will be the impact of these people, should their symptoms not ease or get worse,
right,
on medical costs,
yep,
and unemployment across the country more generally. And so for better or for worse, it's more likely that the system, managed care companies, the physician providers, some of which are at risk, the inpatient and outpatient settings of healthcare, will probably dealing with the brunt of this in the short term before it really gets to the pharmaceutical or medical technology.
Yeah, that's great. That's great context. And I know in terms of the unemployment numbers and sort of the labor shortage, there has been talk about sort of how that's contributing to that shortage as well in terms of the people
Absolutely.
Who are disabled or, have to take time out for one reason or another. So this was a great conversation, Anne. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. That went by very quickly and you gave us an amazing amount of stocks to consider. So thank you for that. Thank you to the audience for tuning in. MarketWatch personal finance reporter Andrew Keshner will talk to Twyla Midwood, who's president of Advanced Tax Center, on what to expect from taxes and IRS customer service this filing season. Thank you all for listening. Thanks again, Anne. Be well and have a nice day.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.